Hello, you're listening to The Sickle and the Hammer, a socialist history of the Soviet Union. Episode 16, Filling in the Blanks. Здравствуйте, товарищи. Hello, comrades, and welcome back. Last time, we finally reached a milestone on our journey. The first milestone, you might say. After 15 episodes of theory and history with primary documents to emphasize the twists and turns of the revolutionary struggle, we saw the workers and soldiers of Petrograd, united under the banner of the Bolshevik Party, emerge victorious. Yes, we completed our exploration of the Russian Revolution. Almost. As I've mentioned several times already, everything thus far has been a prologue to our main focus on the Union of Soviet Socialist Republics. Of course, the story of the revolution is essential to understanding the story of the USSR. But we had to make choices about what to include in our episodes and what not to include. These decisions are the decisions that every single creator, artist, historian, professor, and author have to make when crafting their work, since it is impossible for one work to include the totality of everything. The narrative we have just gone through is therefore accurate, but one might say a bit incomplete. There is also the matter of placing this revolutionary prologue in the proper context in relation to the Soviet Union as a whole. And so now is the obvious opportunity to pause, take a look back, and fill in some of the blanks on our journey, and then take stock of what we have just witnessed. To that end, this is the first of two retrospective episodes. This episode will be, as the title suggests, touching on some of what we skipped over on our way to October. I will be light on the details, for the most part, but I will go through some key organizations, groups, and dynamics that went unmentioned in the main narrative. The second retrospective episode will be a broader discussion of the questions and lessons of the revolution that I think are important to understand and apply to our struggle against capitalism today. From there, we will be moving on completely from our discussion of the Russian Revolution. That is not to say the revolutionary period will not come up again from time to time in different contexts and what have you, but in terms of a detailed examination of the period of February to October 1917, this will be it. The first thing I need to mention that I cannot believe I forgot last time is the dates we used to talk about the October Revolution. I did mention in the last episode that the date of the revolution was the 25th, and that this was according to the old style, or Julian calendar. However, I did not swing the bat fully around and point out that on the new style, or Gregorian calendar, the date is November 7th. This is, in the grand scheme of things, a minor detail. The only reason I am even pointing this out now is because when you read about the revolution in a lot of sources today, they mention the October Revolution taking place in November. So that nobody out there gets confused, I wanted to point that out explicitly. That, and I have been making a big deal about pointing out old versus new style dates this entire time, only to fail to mention it for the biggest event in the entire period. Imagine my embarrassment. I will say, though, we only have a few months left until February 1918, when the Bolsheviks move the entirety of Russia onto the Gregorian calendar. Honestly, I cannot wait. The next somewhat glaring omission, and this one is inarguably more important than the dating system, is the Red Guards. The Red Guards were armed detachments of workers that began spontaneously forming on the basis of factory committees, and later the Soviets, in the spring of 1917. They formed not only in Petrograd and Moscow, but in every region of Russia, the Donbass, the Caucasus, Siberia, the Far East, Central Asia. They were in cities from Samara to Kiev, from Kharkov to Khabarovsk, from Vladivostok to Minsk. Everywhere there was a concentration of industrial workers, the Red Guards appeared. They were, at first, rather disorganized due to their very spontaneous nature. They lacked uniforms, instead relying on papers and red armbands to identify themselves, and for the first several months of the revolution, there was no central authority of the Red Guards responsible for coordinating them at the national level. They therefore functioned strictly in a local capacity, with each group acting autonomously. In the aftermath of the July Days, the Red Guards were declared illegal and suppressed. But when the threat of military dictatorship reared its head during the Kornilov affair, the Red Guards sprang right back up. This time, however, the Red Guards were more closely related to the Bolshevik Party specifically, since the Bolsheviks had been the recognized leaders of the resistance to Kornilov and the defense of the revolution. After the victory over Kornilov, the Red Guards stuck around permanently, and there began to form more coordinated organization of the Guard at the regional and even national level. Even then, though, as a general rule, regional Red Guard units were mostly autonomous, rooted as they were in the local proletariat. The Red Guards in Petrograd were actually at the forefront of the events discussed in episode 15. The Red Guards, the armed workers of the capital, became essentially the troops of the Military Revolutionary Committee in October. It was the Red Guards who took control of the infrastructure in Petrograd. It was the Red Guards who first surrounded the Winter Palace, and then, once joined by the regular armed forces, stormed the palace and arrested the provisional government. Given this, the significance of the Red Guards as a proletarian organization is undeniable. They started as spontaneous detachments of armed workers safeguarding their workplaces and communities from any encroachment from the bosses or government forces on their hard-earned gains of the revolution. But when they began to be organized into a national force under the auspices of the Bolshevik-led Soviets, they turned into the prototype of the Red Army. And that is a big deal indeed. I have mentioned several times in our series thus far that there were a myriad of smaller political parties and popular groups throughout this period, which I was purposefully not mentioning in order to keep things simple. We kept our focus on the biggest parties with the most influence because, in this instance, it was not about the journey and making friends along the way. It was about getting to the destination as quickly as possible. Well, now that we are at the destination, I'm going to touch ever so briefly upon some of the groups we sped right past. This is going to be light on the details, for the most part. There is one exception I will mention in a moment, and it will by no means be exhaustive. As we go through these parties and groups, keep in mind that their existence, their platforms, and any impact they exerted on the events of 1917 do not invalidate the overall narrative thus far. Everything we have discussed is factually accurate and communicates honestly the complex nature of the revolutionary period. So it is mostly in the interest of thoroughness that we talk about the Menshevik Internationalists, the Trudoviks, the Popular Socialists, and the Octoberists. After that, though, we will have a not-so-brief discussion about anarchists in the Russian Revolution. Because out of all the alternatives to Bolshevism present in 1917, anarchism is the only other actually principled revolutionary ideology, and as such, I think it deserves to be looked at more closely and discussed more seriously. But first, the Menshevik Internationalists were a small fraction, in essence the left wing, of the Menshevik Party. They were Menshevik in that they still held to the dogmatic belief that the progression of the economic base was supposed to go feudalism, capitalism, socialism, and that the succession of class domination was supposed to go aristocracy, bourgeoisie, proletariat. As such, the Menshevik Internationalists worried that the Bolsheviks were on the verge of dangerously and irresponsibly leapfrogging over capitalism, the rule of the bourgeoisie, and that such a violation of the Marxist progression of socioeconomic evolution would, in turn, lead Russia and the revolution to ruin. But the Internationalist moniker came about because they, like the Bolsheviks, were extremely anti-war and wanted Russian participation in World War II to end immediately. That is, they recognized the international character of capitalism, the war, and the crisis of capitalism the war represented. They therefore opposed the pro-war stance of some of the prominent Mensheviks, like Don and Tseretelli. Julius Martov, whom I mentioned in episode 3, Cast of Characters, as one of the founders of the Mensheviks in 1903, was an internationalist. In fact, Martov has been present at just about every major event of the revolution. The First and Second Congresses of Soviets, the July Days, the defense against Kornilov, the pre-parliament. Martov was actually a close comrade and personal friend of Vladimir Lenin, and Lenin later lamented that Martov never joined him and the Bolsheviks. As for the greater Menshevik internationalist faction, at the Second Congress of Soviets, they were split on what to do about the Soviet overthrow of the government, which had been organized by the Bolsheviks. For his part, Martov was aghast at what the Bolsheviks had instigated. He called for peace and a restoration of relations between the Petro-Soviet and Bolsheviks on the one hand, and the provisional government on the other. Martov was supported by a large section of the representatives at the Congress, at least until the Mensheviks and right SRs abandoned the Congress, because it turns out that was the section that supported him. Martov himself participated in the walkout, although that was not the end of his participation in revolutionary politics. But other Menshevik internationalists actually stayed in the Congress. Six Menshevik internationalists even made it into the new Central Executive Committee formed by the Second Congress of Soviets. But that's getting a bit ahead now. The ultimate fate of Mensheviks and Menshevism will be explored during the Civil War. For now, it is enough to know that Menshevik internationalists were the left wing of the Menshevik Party. They opposed both the war, but also the seizure of power by the Bolsheviks. And they have played a role in the debates and votes and actions we have discussed in our series thus far. However, I did not mention them before because of the minor nature of that role. Next up, the Trudoviki, or Trudoviks, as they are called in English. Their name derives from the Russian word for labor, trud, and so the name translates roughly as the laborers or the labor group. This was, in fact, their official name, Trudovaya Grupa. The Trudoviks were not an actual official party, but more an offshoot, hodgepodge fraction of both the Social Democrats and the Socialist Revolutionaries. Most of their rank came from the peasantry and the rural intellectuals, although the group did strive to be a kind of unified group of all laboring people, the peasantry and the intellectuals, but also the proletariat. The thing they were most known for was becoming a faction within the Duma starting in 1906. They were a very sizable faction in the first two left-leaning Dumas, whereas the Bolsheviks had boycotted the Duma altogether. Once Nikolai pulled off his coup to ensure the conservative nature of the third Duma, though, the Trudoviks lost a lot of their momentum. Ideologically, the Trudoviks were a muddled combination of everything vaguely socialist. However, their largest base was the peasantry, and so they leaned much closer to the SRs than either the Mensheviks or the Bolsheviks. Throughout 1917, they supported the provisional government and the war effort, which pretty much ensured they would have zero truck with the workers and soldiers as the revolution proceeded. After October, they publicly opposed the Bolsheviks, but before 1917 was over, the group was dissolved. Mind you, this is not an early example of the Bolsheviks ruthlessly persecuting any and all political opponents. No, the end of the Trudoviks was organic. Simply put, their politics were no longer relevant after October. Trying to be a broad coalition of the toiling masses opposed to the party that was building a new state, rooted in the power of the toiling masses, is not exactly a recipe for political success. Moving on, we have the Narodnye Socialisty, or Popular Socialists. They, like the SRs, were known by their initials in Russian, the NRs. This party also sprang up during the revolution of 1905, and was heavily majority intellectuals from the provinces. As their name implies, they were one of the legacy parties of the populists, or Narodniki, of the 1860s and 70s. They, like the Trudoviks, participated in the first two Dumas, but by the third Duma, the popular socialists, now cut out of parliamentary politics, basically stopped existing. However, after the Tsar was overthrown, the party was resurrected in a fashion. They joined forces with the Trudoviks in the summer of 1917, but this means that the popular socialists also supported the provisional government and the war. The party was not in any way actually connected with the working class or the peasantry, and was basically just a bunch of armchair socialists sitting around writing about their ideas instead of organizing the masses in any capacity whatsoever. After the Trudoviks dissolved at the end of 1917, the Popular Socialists dissolved in 1918, for pretty much the exact same reasons as the Trudoviks. The last small group we will discuss are the Oktoberists. The name can be slightly confusing because when you think about the Russian Revolution and October, the first thing that comes to mind is obviously the Bolshevik-led revolution. But this group took its name not from October 1917, but from October 1905. Recall that at the end of the 1905 revolution, Nikolai was forced to sign the October Manifesto, which called for the creation of the Duma and transformed his absolute monarchy into a constitutional monarchy. The Oktoberist platform called for a return to the spirit of the October Manifesto of 1905, which means they wanted an actual, functioning constitutional monarchy. They were a group of right-wing liberals made up of landowners, entrepreneurs, and bureaucrats in the Tsarist regime, and were essentially the unofficial party of the Tsar, once the Tsar was forced to recognize and deal with political parties. Of course, after the February Revolution, with the Tsar gone, the party had basically lost its purpose. But, as it turns out, the diehard monarchists of the Oktoberist Party were not in the slightest opposed to supporting a government without a monarch, as long as that government, in turn, represented their property interests. It is almost as if capitalists have no political allegiance so long as their material interests are served. Anyway, a handful of prominent former Oktoberists took up positions in the provisional government in March 1917. The most famous among them was the arch-conservative Alexander Ivanovich Guchkov, who served as Minister of War in the provisional government until the April days. That was when Milyukov's note became public and the government was forced to at least appear to be shifting to the left, so Guchkov, Milyukov, and a few others were forced to resign, as we discussed in Episode 6. Throughout 1917, many former Oktoberists supported Kerensky, then Kornilov, then Kerensky again, and the entire time absolutely despised the Bolsheviks. And, well, that's it for the smaller groups. I hope you can see why I chose to skip over them. The story I was telling about the Russian Revolution was of the success of the Bolsheviks in organizing and mobilizing the masses to take control of their fates into their own hands and away from the bourgeoisie and aristocracy. None of the parties or groups mentioned thus far, with the possible exception of the Menshevik Internationalists, had any tangible impact on the events of the revolution. But hey, now, if you go back and do your own reading and study and come across these groups, you will know where they fit. But this still leaves us with what I called the most principled ideological alternative to the Bolsheviks in the revolutionary period, anarchism. So after the break, we will discuss in detail just what anarchist political theory is and its impact on the revolution. If you are enjoying this show and you are in a position to do so, please consider supporting me at patreon.com/sovietpod. I have some good news and bad news. The good news is I'm happy to say the Patreon page is fully functional now. All my current episodes have been posted there. There are different tiers with different bonuses, and we are forming a nice little community. The bad news is you are listening to this episode late. All new episodes come out immediately on Patreon first, but then 10 days later on the RSS feed. Early access on Patreon starts at just $5 a month, so if you don't want to wait, head on over and sign up. Also, please leave a rating and review on whatever podcast services you are using, and please share the show with anyone you think might be interested. The more we get the word out, the more our community grows. Now, back to the show. I mentioned anarchism very briefly in episode 2 when describing what Lenin had to say about this revolutionary ideology, and in particular, what he saw as its limitations and errors. To refresh your memory, I gave a definition of anarchism as an ideology that emphasizes the role of power dynamics and how groups and individuals relate to each other along axes of power being exercised. In contrast to Marxism, which emphasizes the role of class dynamics and how groups and individuals relate to each other along axes of control and ownership of the means of production. Anarchism has been around for centuries. Its roots go back to even before Marx and Engels, although the more modern iterations of anarchism really started to form in direct opposition to Marxist political theory. So surely, as one of the oldest revolutionary traditions around, and given that one of the most famous anarchists in history was the Russian Bakunin, the anarchists must have been incredibly active across Russia throughout 1917. Right? Well, the thing is, not so much actually. Do not get me wrong, there is a ton written from the anarchist point of view about the Russian Revolution and the Soviet Union. There are books, essays, and blog posts galore. And of course, the fates of Dniester Makhno and his Makhnovshchina during the Civil War, and then the Kronstadt Rebellion of 1921, have been subjects of intense scrutiny and study for over a century now. In general, these events have been held up as evidence that the Bolsheviks betrayed the revolution, socialism, communism, the working class, and fell prey to what anarchists consider to be the fatal flaw of Marxist revolutionary theory, authoritarianism. At the root of anarchist arguments against the Bolsheviks, the USSR, and Marxism-Leninism in general is the rejection of the authoritarian aspect of Marxist-Leninist ideology. MLs, as they are colloquially called, believe that the use of force in pursuit of the revolutionary goal of building a post-capitalist society is essential. But as Engels, Lenin, and just about every other ML revolutionary leader will tell you, by use of force, they mean a revolutionary proletariat state, which will direct force against the bourgeoisie and defend the interests of the proletariat. This is, of course, the opposite of how a bourgeois state operates under capitalism. But anarchists believe that the entire goal of a revolution is to make impossible the use of force by one group against another. That is, the goal of the revolution is to destroy the state, not to appropriate it. The thing is, both anarchists and MLs agree that a state is the organized use of force in society. The irreconcilable difference between the two ideologies is that MLs want to use the state to transition from capitalism to communism, whereas anarchists reject any use of state power as anathema to any revolutionary emancipation of the masses. Thus, anarchists will tell you, in setting up their states, Marxist-Leninists always wind up betraying the revolution and the masses. The USSR was therefore not actually a revolutionary society. We will, of course, be having detailed discussions of both Makhno and the Kronstadt Rebellion, as well as grappling with this anarchist narrative and criticism of Marxism-Leninism and the true nature of the USSR's use of force. Here's a quick little sneak peek, though. Things are not nearly as straightforward and simple as anarchists claim. And of course, I refer everyone back to Lenin's State and Revolution, as well as the very short essay by Engels titled On Authority, as general theoretical refutations of the anarchist position. Obviously, as an ML myself, you all know what I think. But again, we are here right now to fill in the blank of what anarchists were doing during 1917, and how they impacted the events of the revolution. And when it comes to a chronicle of anarchists and anarchism in the year 1917, there's hardly anything. At least, not much that I could find. None of the sources I have used thus far have had anything to say about anarchism and the revolution, and searching online for anarchism and Russian Revolution will turn up a lot of Reddit and other blog posts about how anarchism is the only true revolutionary movement, how the Bolsheviks turned out to be evil, etc. I did find a few things, though. There is the work by Soviet historian Yemelyan Mikhailovich Yaroslavsky, titled Anarchism in Russia, published in 1939. But that covers the entire history of anarchism in the country, and only talks about anarchists during the revolutionary period in very broad terms. There is also an essay from 1967 by the famous American historian of Russian anarchism, Paul Avrich, titled Anarchists of the Russian Revolution. So, drawing on these two sources, here is what I feel confident saying about the role of anarchism in Russia, 1917. Avrich identifies three tendencies of anarchism in the revolutionary period: anarcho-communism, anarcho-syndicalism, and anarcho-individualism. I make no claim that Avrich's descriptions of these tendencies accurately describe them today. He was writing specifically about Russia in the revolutionary and immediate post-revolutionary period, so what these terms mean today could be different. With that said, the anarcho-communists wanted immediately to start building a classless, stateless society in which Russia would be rooted in a romantic understanding of the peasant commune, or Mir. They envisioned a decentralized agrarian society as the ideal. The syndicalists saw the path forward to be the organizing of the working class, but their conception of this organization did not extend further than organizing workers into trade unions, and particularly the factory committees that had started springing up after the overthrow of the Tsar. As for the individualists, they rejected wholesale the very idea of organizing any sort of society. They drew inspiration from, of all places, Nietzsche and his Übermensch, and claimed that only standalone individuals could guarantee their own autonomy and freedom from coercion by others. A brief critique of each of these tendencies will suffice for our purposes. For what I hope are obvious reasons, individualism can be rejected out of hand as completely impractical. Human beings are social creatures. Throughout our entire existence as a species, we have relied on others for help and have felt compelled to help others. As Marx put it, we enter into manifold relations with each other, and this is one of the defining traits of being human. The idea of a revolutionary society composed of millions of individuals lone wolfing it through life is, to be blunt, rather laughable, and would actually be extremely dangerous if ever attempted in earnest. When it comes to the anarcho-communists, the obvious flaw in their thinking was a rejection of large-scale industry and a longing for a simpler, more bucolic society. As someone who has lived in capitalist cities his entire life, I am very sympathetic to the desire to live in a more communal and harmonious way with nature, and to the desire to escape the grind of capitalist industry and production. But, as a Marxist-Leninist, I recognize that the way to build that kind of society is not by eschewing technological progress or renouncing industry, but by wresting control over the means of production away from the bourgeoisie and placing it in the hands of the proletariat. I further recognize that, as long as the bourgeoisie remains organized in states around the world, a proletarian state is necessary to protect worker control over the means of production from the inevitable and incessant attempts of the bourgeoisie to take it back. Finally, the anarcho-syndicalists of the Russian Revolution had definitely the most practical approach to the revolutionary situation out of the three tendencies. They recognized that the working class was the key to everything, and their emphasis on factory committees and trade unions is laudable. But, if you recall, from way back in episode 2, our good friend Lenin argued in What Is to Be Done that trade unions have very real limitations in their ability to organize a revolutionary society. To refresh everyone's memories, Lenin's argument is that trade unions are limited to organizing only workers of the trade in question. The same can be said of factory committees, which were not around in 1902 when he was writing. There is no reason that unions and committees cannot collaborate, but at the end of the day, a union's purpose is to protect and further the material interests of its members. The problem is, the question of how to build a broader revolutionary society requires an answer that is more complex than simply trade unions and workplace committees. Some anarcho-syndicalists, even in the early 20th century, but also today, envision an overarching entity tasked with managing coordination between the various labor unions and committees. But that starts to sound very much like, you know, a state. Perhaps the anarcho-syndicalist state would be less centralized, more of a loose federation, which can be recalled and reformed at will. But the crucial question is, when it comes to any decisions made by this entity, how powerful an enforcement mechanism should there be? If there is no such mechanism, if the entity has no power to enforce decisions, then of what utility is it? What is its point of existence? And if there is any kind of enforcement mechanism whatsoever, I got news for you all. That is a state. So anarcho-syndicalists seem, to me at least, to be stuck in a kind of intermediate mindset. They know the workers are key, which is good. They usually figure out or intuit that some sort of overarching entity is needed to coordinate and facilitate worker collaboration, which is also good. But they either want to set up what is functionally a state but are loath to call it that, or recognize that whatever they call it, it would in fact be a state, and so cannot bring themselves to do it. Beyond these three general tendencies, however, many anarchists in 1917 actually found common cause with the Bolsheviks, and with Lenin in particular. A lot of them actually appreciated how radical Lenin was, especially compared to the other prominent socialist leaders of the spring of 1917. And because of their effectiveness in organizing the workers and soldiers, and even the peasants in late summer and early autumn, anarchists supported the Bolsheviks in the quest to overthrow the provisional government, right up until they succeeded. As soon as the Bolsheviks started building their own proletariat state to replace Kerensky's bourgeois one, anarchists became bitter enemies of the Bolsheviks, just as they had been enemies of Kerensky. When it comes to anarchists organizing among the masses, they held some sway among the workers and soldiers. There were even a handful of anarchist deputies in the Soviets, and even some in the Military Revolutionary Committee. But the number of anarchists working in the Soviets and the MRC were only a tiny percentage of all anarchists in the country. Most of them refused to join these organizations on the principle of eschewing the use of force. Not that they objected to the use of force against the bourgeoisie, but they already knew that they disagreed with the means the Bolsheviks and Soviets would employ, because Lenin and the Bolsheviks did not at all try to hide their goal of building a worker state. I think it is fair to say that anarchists generally had very limited success in organizing workers, soldiers, or peasants when compared to the Bolsheviks. The working class and peasantry throughout 1917 were spontaneously organizing themselves first into committees and Soviets, then socialist parties, then concentrating into the one socialist party, and then we're going back to the Soviets, united in that one party, with concrete, explicit goals in mind. The anarchists, by contrast, eschewed party politics and the Soviets. This meant the anarchists were not meeting the masses where they were, both ideologically and literally. Ideologically, because the anarchists rejected the organic self-organization of the masses, believing it was not the correct kind of self-organization because it would lead to the use of force and the creation of a new state. And literally, anarchists were not meeting the working class in the physical spaces of the Soviets and the Bolshevik Party, where they were concentrating. The reason why this happened has to do with what most Marxist-Leninists identify as the basic weakness of anarchism as a revolutionary ideology. While anarchists will always say they have no problem with organizations in principle, as long as it is bottom-up and completely free of coercion, what this translates to in practice is very low organizational capacity. In other words, anarchists, at least in the instance of the Russian Revolution, were ineffective at organizing the working class specifically because they generally do not believe in the kind of discipline and rules that come along with effective mass organizing. The anarchist position is that the individuals can organize themselves however they like, so long as each individual has full autonomy to leave or start a new organization under whatever conditions they want. But within their organizations and within an anarchist society, they want everything to be harmonious and freely agreed upon by all, with little to no use of force. In the end, anarchists value the individual's autonomy above any principles of organization. And so, while at least at first, anarchists work together, forming this or that syndicate or federation, this cooperation tends to last only as long as everyone is on the same page. As soon as there is a difference in opinion, we see that the history of anarchism is replete with splinter groups, factions, and dissolutions. And really, when it comes to the question at hand of anarchists and the Russian Revolution, the historical record speaks for itself. During 1917, anarchists of all stripes had just as free a hand as the Bolsheviks did to organize the working class. Even more so, one could argue, since the anarchists were never the subject of wide-scale derision and slander in the bourgeois press, and they were not persecuted by the authorities all through July and August, unlike the Bolsheviks. But throughout the entire year, with the exceptions already mentioned, anarchists eschewed the Soviets and party politics, preferring to organize themselves outside of the working class. And so, unsurprisingly, they wound up outside the working class. The Bolsheviks, by contrast, identified the Soviets early on as the embryo of working class power in action. So, they sought the Soviets out. Furthermore, the Bolsheviks practiced the organizational principle of democratic centralism, by which every individual gets a voice in the discussion of what decision the group should make. But then, every individual is expected to abide the decision once made, whether or not they personally agree with it. It was precisely these organizational principles which provided a platform for the working class to express its ideas and cohere its goals into articulable revolutionary action. So is it really any surprise that, in the end, the working class followed, of its own volition, the Bolsheviks instead of the anarchists? But I do want to be fair to any anarchist comrades listening, and so I must point out that although I am speaking here primarily of the example of anarchism in the Russian Revolution, this is not the only example of anarchism being pursued as a revolutionary ideology. And although it was not successful here, that does not mean anarchism has never had any successes. There are a few small anarchist experiments that these comrades champion. For example, the Zapatistas in southern Mexico, the anarchists of the Spanish Civil War, and Rojava in present-day Syria. I also want to point out that, as a Marxist-Leninist, I ultimately agree with anarchists on a lot. Both MLs and anarchists are principled anti-capitalists, and both ultimately want the same thing: a stateless, moneyless, classless society in which the means of production are owned in common and used to satisfy human need for all, instead of being owned by individuals to satisfy the greed of a few. Furthermore, I will go on the record as an ML and say that I do think there are some important criticisms about the exercise of power that anarchists make and which Marxist-Leninists would do well to engage. Revolutionary power needs to be wielded very carefully, because if it is not, it can lead to ruin. There is plenty that even principled MLs can and should criticize about how the Soviet Union exercised its power. But where MLs and anarchists differ is in both the theoretical and practical approach to the question of how we get where we want to go. Theoretically, they differ on the question of state power, as we have discussed. And in practice, well, the simple truth is anarchism as a revolutionary ideology has, as of this writing, failed to generate a revolutionary movement that challenges the hegemony of capitalism. To the extent the Zapatistas and Rojava have revolutionized and improved the lives of the people living there, these societies deserve their props. But to be blunt, they are not making any headway in the struggle against the hegemony of capital. This is even without getting into a detailed criticism of these societies, because, as with all revolutionary projects, there is lots to criticize, but that is obviously beyond our scope here. The Soviet Union, on the other hand, was the first successful challenge to capitalism in history, And it, along with every other successful challenge to capitalism in history, was not built on anarchist principles, but on Marxist-Leninist principles. Now, I know the Soviet Union was not a utopia, but utopias cannot exist, and so we need to wrestle with the good and the bad of the reality of the USSR via the lens of dialectical materialism. Hey, look at that. It's the slogan of the show. There is more that can be said about the age-old struggle between anarchists and Marxist-Leninists. Some of that will be said when discussing Machno and Kronstadt. And I promise that during those discussions, I will strive for the kind of fairness toward anarchists which I attempted here, even if I ultimately disagree with them in key areas. For now, I will close by saying that, sadly, I think, despite whatever common cause MLs and anarchists have with each other, and whatever aid and support they can lend each other in resisting capitalist predation, when it comes to actually moving past capitalism, the two ideologies are ultimately mutually exclusive. Marxist-Leninists want to build a proletarian state. Anarchists want to tear the state down. This is why we see over and over again in the history of socialist revolutions and in the history of the Soviet Union, deadly clashes between the two. Okay, that was a lot. We are going to close out this episode with the briefest of introductions to perhaps the most impactful dynamic present throughout 1917, and yet one which I absolutely completely ignored, the question of nationalities in the former Russian Empire. The Russian Empire was one of the most multinational and multi-ethnic polities to ever exist in human history. Throughout the roughly three centuries that it existed, the empire conquered lands from present-day Poland to Mongolia, from Iran to Japan. But by the 20th century, modern empires were contending with increasingly more violent nationalist movements. As I am sure many of you know, the famous trigger for World War I was the assassination of Archduke Franz Ferdinand of the Austro-Hungarian Empire at the hands of the Bosnian Serb nationalist Gavrilo Princip. In Russia, the multitude of nationalities were in various stages of struggle against the Tsars for their own forms of national liberation and self-determination. The thing is, the struggle for national liberation and self-determination is the struggle against colonialism and imperialism, and that struggle is intimately and directly connected with the struggle against capitalism in both the 20th and 21st centuries. But even just limiting ourselves to Russia 1917, the ways in which the nationalist movements impacted the events of the revolution are numerous. To take just one example, on the eve of the July Days, the first coalition government, headed by Georgi Lvov, collapsed specifically because the government had reached a compromise with a group of Ukrainian nationalists. But the cadets in the coalition rejected the compromise and resigned in protest. The fact that there was no functioning government right at the moment of armed insurrection of a section of the workers and soldiers in Petrograd handicapped the ability of Lvov's successor, Kerensky, to deal with the crisis. Furthermore, the lack of a new government through most of July hampered his ability to repress effectively the Bolsheviks in the aftermath. We discussed this at length in Episode 9, Reaction and Recovery. Kerensky wasn't even officially named prime minister of a new government until the 24th of July. This disarray in the bourgeois state, triggered by the national question in Ukraine, allowed the Bolsheviks to survive the repression of July and emerge all the stronger in August, which then allowed them to defeat first Kornilov and then Kerensky, thereby changing the entire course of world history. So the nationalist movements, yes, plural, movements, the Ukrainians were just one of many. These movements of 1917 directly impacted the events of that year. However, for our purposes, we do not need a blow-by-blow of what was happening in Finland and Ukraine and the Caucasus region and Siberia and Central Asia. What interests us is how the Soviet Union addressed the question of national liberation and self-determination. When the time comes, and it is coming very soon, we will examine what Lenin and other Bolsheviks, including Stalin, developed as the official nationalist policy of the party, and then we will examine how they put that theory into practice. But I can tell you right now, there is a reason the 100-plus different nationalities of the Soviet Union were, for the most part, happy and prosperous for the majority of the Union's existence. Why national liberation became a buzz phrase only after the introduction of Gorbachev's perestroika policies, and why the accusations of Soviet imperialism and national oppression ring hollow to anyone who has actually studied the question. There is, in fact, quite a bit we can learn from the Soviets on how a revolutionary proletarian state addresses the question of decolonization and national self-determination. It is, honestly, one of the things I am personally most excited about discussing. And that will do it for this episode. Next time, we will ask and answer a series of questions designed to lead us to the answer to one overarching question. What should we, as socialists, communists, and anti-capitalists of all stripes, take as the primary lessons of the Russian Revolution and the victory of the Bolsheviks, the masses, and the Soviets? Put another way, why does any of this matter in the first place? Thank you for listening. All translations from the Russian text are provided by me, unless otherwise noted. Any errors or inaccuracies are therefore my own. If you are enjoying the show, please consider supporting me at patreon.com/sovietpod. There are tiers with different incentives, and we're also forming a really nice community over there, so go check it out. A special thank you to my commissars, Big Easy H, Kat Brannigan, Comrade Red, Dr. Fate, Hyacinth Dathenes, Jay, Jack, Josue Ponce, Rasmus Svensson, Ryan Fowler, and Sam McGeever. You guys are awesome. If you have not done so already, please leave a rating and review on your podcast service of choice, and share this show with anyone you think might enjoy it. Also, feel free to reach out to me on Patreon or at sovietpod@gmail.com if you have any questions, feedback, or just want to say hi. I hope you enjoyed this episode of The Sickle and the Hammer, a socialist history of the Soviet Union. До свидания.